This is Melbourne. Welcome to another fortnightly edition of Shire Network News, one of the few remaining voices of sanity and rationality and enlightenment values left in a world where hysterical arm-waving emotion is regarded as a replacement for actual, you know, arguments and facts, silly, outmoded stuff like that. I'm Tom Payne, and this week's feature interview is with Asia Times columnist and well-known doom-monger Spengler, who recently unmasked himself as actually being David Goldman, which takes away a bit from the mystique of anonymity, but does nothing to affect the quality of his writing and thinking. I asked him if, as he seems to be suggesting in his columns, that the West is sleepwalking towards a self-inflicted doom.
There are parts of the world which really are in decline, though surely not all. India and China are not in decline. They seem to be doing very well indeed, and Australia seems quite prosperous, and I think the United States will do all right. But Europe surely is in decline. Demographically, it's a disaster. Russia is in terrible shape. Japan as well. And in fact, the fastest rate of fertility decline and the greatest prospective social crisis is in the Muslim-majority countries.
Columnist David Goldman, a.k.a. Spengler, coming up shortly. Also in the show, we hear from Merrill Urish, who remarks on the fact that President Obama has more czars than the Romanovs. First, as always, a little blog news. In more news from the front lines of the war we're not allowed to refer to as a war, against an enemy we're not permitted to name for vaguely defined reasons that none of our leaders seem to actually believe can be achieved, comes this bit of encouraging news. British soldiers are being told they cannot train with live ammunition unless they're actually going to Afghanistan. Ministry of Defence cutbacks mean that troops are being issued with blank rounds, which cost about 10 pence, instead of live rounds, which cost about 30 pence. The Ministry of Defence says the ever-improving quality of computer simulation has also reduced the need for live fire training. Conservative MP Patrick Mercer, who was an officer in the infantry, and thereby actually knows what he's talking about, which disqualifies him from being an MP, says cutting back on live firing could have serious consequences. We can't have a pop gun army. The next thing you know, we'll be reduced to Dad's Army-style training, shouting, bang, bang. Here's how I imagine the troops would probably have responded to this.
What the hell are we supposed to use, man? Harsh language?
Fortunately, the British Army comes already equipped with plenty of that. The United Nations has come under attack from Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic movement, which currently controls the Gaza Strip. It's for a simple, yet rather horrifying thing. UNRWA, a United Nations agency, is responsible for the education system in Gaza, and you'll just have to excuse the use of the word education in the same sentence as Gaza. It means something very different there than it does where you and I come from. It turns out that the history syllabus for Gaza schoolchildren next year is going to mention the Holocaust. Now, naturally, this is completely unacceptable to Hamas, which calls the Holocaust A, an invention of the Zionists, B, an exaggeration by the Zionists designed to win them sympathy from Western powers, C, a conspiracy by the Zionists to persuade their Nazi allies to murder European Jews en masse so that those same dead European Jews could then seize the peaceful, independent state of Palestine, and D, a bloody good start. And for those of you who think that Holocaust denial or trivialization is just something we're going to have to learn to grin and bear from the Arabs, how about these lovely comments on the Guardian story about this issue from a chap in Ireland called Gabriel? Jews need to get on with their lives and stop this victim mentality. A lot of gypsies and Romas died as well. I thought gypsies were Romas. And what about Rwanda? Slavery? Please get on with it and stop being petty. Petty? Ah, oh, 6 million people. What's the difference? I could knock that off on my way to work. Why don't all Western schools teach about slavery, imperialism, or Americans teach about stolen Indian land and the massacre of Indians, or the Australians teach about stolen Aboriginal land and how Australia was resettlement for UK criminals? Thank you for your input, Gabriel. I'm sure your remarks about how slavery and relations with the Indigenous people are never even mentioned in Western schools will come as a shocking blow to all of us who, of course, have never even heard of such topics mentioned in public. Not once. Never in school textbooks. Certainly there was a conspiracy of silence about them at university. Thank you for bringing these previously hidden topics to our attention, Gabriel. I'm sure this also comes as a surprise to historians Howard Zinn and Manning Clark. Now, you've all heard of an IED, an improvised explosive device. Well, thanks to the vast advances being made in technology by the enemy, as well as by ourselves, we can now add a new acronym, the IRED, or Improvised Rectal Explosive Device, Al-Qaeda's newest and potentially most horrifying weapon. A more than usually suicidal suicide bomber who tried to assassinate a Saudi prince last week used an unusual place to conceal his explosive charge. Okay, you can see where I'm going with this, can't you? Yep, this guy wasn't just a suicide bomber, more of a suicide bummer, a weapon of arse destruction, if you will. As is often the case with highly experimental new technology, there was a small problem, and although the explosives were successfully smuggled into the meeting with Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, there was something of a problem with premature detonation, which gives the term explosive discharge a whole and rather disgusting new meaning. The force of the blast was directed downwards away from the intended target, and I imagine it must have launched what was left of the guy into the air. As a result of this latest development in terrorist technology, visitors to the Middle East are requested to exercise extreme caution if anyone approaches them and asks them to pull his finger. And now part of what I suspect may be a never-ending series, academics, our moral and intellectual superiors. One of the great things about the world of blogs and podcasts is that you sometimes stumble on sites that you might not normally discover because they're a bit off your normal reading, but which keep you coming back again and again because they're just so darn interesting. So it is with British blogger David Thompson, whom we actually had on as a featured guest, I think, a couple of years ago. In his blog, he occasionally picks up on something so bizarre and quirky that I feel I just have to steal it. I mean, refer to it and pass it on to you, the listener. This is what he has to say about an announcement for the Meat Animal Meat, M-E-E-T, Animal M-E-A-T, Meat Animal Meat International Conference, organised by the Centre for Gender Research at Uppsala University in Sweden. Yes, it's going to be one of those. Sadly, the opportunity to participate in the conference has come and gone. Listeners are left to imagine the dizzying insights offered by the keynote speakers. Among them, Carol J. Adams, a feminist vegetarian theorist and author of The Sexual Politics of Meat, a feminist vegetarian critical theory in which she explores a relationship between patriarchal values and meat-eating by interweaving the insights of feminism, vegetarianism, and literary theory. The book has been described by the New York Times, no less, as a Bible of vegan community, and in it Ms. Adams advances her belief that what, or more precisely who, we eat is determined by the patriarchal politics of our culture. Patriarchy is a gender system that is implicit in human-animal relationships. Manhood is constructed in our culture by access to meat-eating and control of other bodies. Also sharing her wonderful wisdom is Judith Halberstam, Professor of English and Gender Studies at USC and author of In a Queer Time and Place, Transgender Bodies, Subcultural Lives, in which she proposes a conception of time and space independent of the influence of normative heterosexual familial lifestyle. Halberstam's area of, dare I say the word, expertise, includes examining queer temporality, queer uses of time and space that are developed in opposition to the institutions of family, heterosexuality, and reproduction. Is that why my gay neighbour is always late? Uh-huh. And one can only tremble with regret at missing Richard Twine's pithy contribution, Embodying Posthumanist Intersectionality and Resisting Transhumanist Enhancement Through Feminist Veganism. Hush now, dry your tears. In the comments section of the post, one person said this sort of academic drivel certainly made him want to go out and spend $35,000 a year to send their kid to a place like that. And responding to that comment, a second person said, It made him want to spend $35,000 on explosives. Let us turn our unflinching gaze towards the old Dart once more, where our old friends, the UK Muslim Public Affairs Committee, have uncovered a monstrous anti-Muslim conspiracy. It seems they don't approve of one of the Labour Party candidates standing for next year's local elections in London. They can't grasp how a person of this sort could possibly have been elected to stand in Camden, which has a sizeable Muslim population. Here's how the MPAC lay out the situation for British Muslims. I'll take away the candidate's name and you'll see why in a second. Imagine my surprise when I established that candidate X is the Labour Party candidate for next year's local elections in the London borough of Camden, where she is standing in St Pancras and Somers Town ward. According to the 2001 census, the ward has a Muslim population of 22.9%. The Jewish population is 0.8%. What on earth was the Camden Constituency Labour Party thinking when it selected her, and where were the Muslim members of that branch on the night of her selection? What grounds does MPAC have for objecting to this person? Let's remove the phrase Candidate X and use her name, Lucianne Berger. Oh, right. Equally revealing is a comment left on the Muslim Public Affairs Committee's site in response to this monstrous revelation. What is really needed is something like the House Un-American Affairs Committee to demand that all Jews make public their absolute condemnation of Israel's inhuman genocidal activities. Like in 50s USA, those Jews that refuse to make a clear declaration should be prevented from holding any public office, and self-evidently, those who express support for Zionism should be barred from any public role, including employment in any publicly funded body. They should also be prevented from holding senior posts in major institutions, and ideally, they should be stripped of their UK citizenship. Wait, I'm confused. Was McCarthyism supposed to be a bad thing or not? Or is it only bad if it's applied to the left? Gosh, it's hard to keep track of concepts like good and evil these days, isn't it? Well, that's enough blog news. Now for our feature interview. It's with David Goldman, who recently outed himself as the columnist known as Spengler, whose writing in the Asia Times has become very popular among those of us with a fairly gloomy view of where the West is going at the moment. I asked him the obvious question you'd ask anyone who chose the name Spengler to hide behind. Are we all doomed?
No, the West isn't doomed at all, but big parts of it are, and big parts of the East are doomed too. The reason I chose the name Spengler, first of all, was a pure joke, because Asia Times is an Asian publication. To have a columnist with the name of the author of The Clown of the West seemed amusing. But I also wanted to emphasize that there are parts of the world which really are in decline, though surely not all. India and China are not in decline. They seem to be doing very well indeed, and Australia seems quite prosperous, and I think the United States will do all right. But Europe surely is in decline. Demographically, it's a disaster. Russia is in terrible shape. Japan as well. And in fact, the fastest rate of fertility decline and the greatest prospective social crisis is in the Muslim-majority countries. There, you might call that a decline of the East.
Which is interesting because for a lot of people, they see what's going on around the world, the clash of civilizations thesis that Samuel Huntington put forth, and they see Islam as on a mission, on a crusade, as Islam as a civilization is rising, not declining.
If you read what the Islamists actually wrote, say Qutb in Egypt of the 1950s or Hassan al-Banna before him, they're quite convinced that their societies were very fragile and at the edge of breakdown and very likely to cease to be Islamic at all. In fact, probably the most fragile society in the world today is Iran, which, to paraphrase Oscar Wilde, has gone from infancy to senility without passing through adolescence. It has a young population that simply has stopped having babies. They have enormous social pathologies. And I think Iran's militancy is a response not to strength, but to weakness and fragility.
Looking at what's happening with the burgeoning Muslim populations in Europe and their internal, what appears to be, self-confidence, I'm reminded of the 1890s and the ghost dance phenomenon among the last of the Indian tribes in America. They did this thing called the ghost dance, which they thought would make them invulnerable to bullets, and it was the last sort of Indian rising against the West. do you think perhaps really what you're saying is this phenomenon of Islamism, this attack on the West, is really a form of ghost dance, a last roll of the dice, because to a certain extent they've looked into the future and they're not in it?
Well, according to the best historical accounts, Sitting Bull was very unlikely to have developed nuclear weapons. So the degree of threat, I think, is entirely incomparable. And we're also talking about a very small population of American Aboriginals as opposed to 1.25 billion Muslims, or roughly a fifth of the human race. I wouldn't put it quite so strongly, but what I would say is that countries immersed in traditional society with its certainties and its rigid hierarchy have terrible problems coming to terms with globalization and the modern world. I think it's profoundly evident in Iran, where you've got a young population which has the fertility of an Italy or Germany, which is, say, about 1.5 children per woman, a rate of drug addiction 10 times that of the United States, very high rates of prostitution and other social pathologies. Iran is in danger of social breakdown after a generation, and I think the leaders of Iran, who are trying to maintain what I like to call the Persian pocket empire, are hoping that by raising the Shia, the minority sect of Islam, which they adhere to from Lebanon to Afghanistan, they'll be able to garner enough power to break out as opposed to break down, as it were.
So this aggression we're seeing is not necessarily fueled by confidence, but perhaps by an internal lack of confidence.
Well, this is true, but that doesn't mean it's any less dangerous. For many years, Turkey was referred to as the sick man of Europe all through the second half of the 19th century. That did not deter the Turks from slaughtering perhaps 3 million Christians during and after World War II, Armenians, Greeks and Abyssinians and others. So the danger of the breakdown of Islam is that it will occur very slowly and certain parts of it will become radicalized. Now, I don't mean to argue that all Muslims or all Muslim countries are radical at all. I think the vast majority of the 25 million or so Muslims in Europe really are there for economic reasons and want nothing more to earn a living. The problem is, if you have 10 or 15% who are highly radicalized, that's a minority in Europe of several millions, which represents an enormous threat to European society and has European governments running for cover.
Well, of course, we don't know if there are 10 or 15% that are highly radicalized because we're not even really allowed to ask the question.
Well, that's a terrific problem. We don't have very good numbers on what's happening in Muslim communities. There is a new book by Christopher Caldwell, who's a very bright American journalist, claiming that minarets will sprout out of St. Peter's Cathedral and Islam will take over Europe. I've heard much less alarmist views by any number of European analysts, but I think the point is not whether you have a European Muslim majority and Europe turns into a fair imitation of Saudi Arabia. It's much more that the radicalized minority holds European governments to ransom and threatens to paralyze European society.
You don't need too many incidents of terror for societies and governments to be terrorized.
Well, when societies face a civilizational dead end, many things can happen. The Soviet Union fell without a shot being fired. They simply gave up and decided to become something else. Other societies, for example, the Plains Indians in Usada during the Ghost Dance, decided to fight until there weren't enough left to fight. They fought essentially to the death. In the case of the highly variegated and enormously differentiated Muslim world, we're talking again about a fifth of humanity. I think you'll see many different responses. Some will successfully modernize, but I think that'll be a minority. Some will simply become resigned and go directly from traditional society to sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And some will become suicide bombers and do terrible things. And the problem is not that all Muslims are radical or all Muslims are evil. I don't mean to say that, but that there is such a large radicalized minority that it probably has support in the numbers of hundreds of millions. And that's quite frightening.
Well, let's look at the other side of this coin, which is European civilization. There seems to have been a collapse, not really in economic power, but certainly a strange collapse in confidence. Right at the height of Europe's apparent triumph, 1989, the Berlin Wall fell, communism was destroyed, the 50-year project of containing communism was successful, and sort of right at that point, Europe seemed to sort of heave a sigh and turnover and seems to be playing dead for some reason.
My thesis, which is certainly not a majority or particularly popular one, is that human beings don't really like life without the prospect of immortality. In other words, mortality is not really tolerable unless you have the hope of something better. The term secular society, I think, in a sense, is an oxymoron, because secular societies simply haven't functioned. In those countries where religious faith was really exterminated by communist regimes, you have the lowest birth rates in the world. The population of places like the Ukraine or Belarus or Bulgaria will fall by nearly half by mid-century, and Russia is only slightly behind them. In the most secular European countries, you have extremely low birth rates. And by contrast, if you look at the United States, which is famously the most religious country in the industrial world, you have birth rates at around replacement. Israel, which has a lot of religious people and has sort of a religious basis for being there, has a fertility rate of 3 children per average woman, which is the highest in the industrial world. So there is a correlation, which I think can be demonstrated statistically, between the degree of religious faith or sense of something better than this life and people's taste for life itself.
So secularism, to a certain extent, contains within it the seeds of its own destruction.
I think that's exactly right. Human life, in a sense, is an acquired taste. Life by itself is tragic. It's by definition a failure because we're going to die, and unless we have the sense that there is something better that we can aspire to, it's very difficult to summon up the taste for it and the will to live. So I believe that the destruction of religious life in Europe through two world wars, a response to the horrors of communism and fascism, has really doomed Europe to a ghost existence and a slow decline. I think really the same is true with Japan, with a collapse of its self-confidence and its national religion after World War II.
Does the collapse of Europe as a Western civilization presage the collapse of the West as a whole, or just Europe? Does the West continue to exist elsewhere?
Well, I think the United States will do very well indeed. And Western ideas, remember, are embodied in religious doctrines and culture, which is being absorbed by other places. So I'm not at all pessimistic about the world. For example, if you look at Western high culture, China has 60 million pupils in schools studying classical music, studying instruments.
And in fact, Christianity is very much on the rise in China.
Yes, there are probably 140 million Christians in China. How deep that is and how broad is very hard to tell, because many of them are very recently Christianized and may not have a clear idea of exactly what it means. But surely, given the enormous numbers of people who consider themselves Christians, the potential for the absorption of Western ideals, both in religion and culture, is enormous, and Christianity is by far the fastest growing religion in Africa as well. So just as Christianity has disappeared from its original heartland in the Middle East and moved to Europe, even if Western culture fails in Europe, one hopes that the idea of the sanctity of the individual, which is at the center of Western civilization, will be embraced by other peoples, and these ideas will flourish elsewhere.
The West has often migrated, hasn't it? It's a very malleable civilization. It's not necessarily ethnocentric, as some other civilizations are. It's about ideas, isn't it, and values. It's not just about people and blood and ethnicity.
Well, speaking as a Jew, coming from the people to whom first occurred the idea that the individual was holy and that the weakest and poorest were specially loved by God, which I consider the basis of Western civilization. It's interesting to be in Australia, because if Moses had led the children of Israel to Australia, we would have had very few problems. We would have lived quite happily. But we happen to sit on the land bridge between Europe, Africa, and Asia, right in the middle of everyone's paths to everywhere. And I think the point precisely was to make that idea known to all of humanity.
Well, what do you think the future holds for Jews? At the moment, you know, Israel is pretty imperiled. Jews are very much a minority in the West. Should we be talking to evangelical Christians, for example, because Christianity seems to be the core of the West? What should our relationship be with Christians?
Well, one of the great developments of the last 20 and 30 years is the increasing recognition by Christians that Judaism is not simply the fundament of their religion in terms of ideas, but that the Jewish people, as a living witness to these ideas, has in a certain mysterious way a fundamental importance to the health of Christian life. So we've seen not only the well-documented support of evangelical Christians in the United States for the State of Israel, but we've also seen from the Catholic Church, starting with John Paul II, a profound and new kind of sympathy towards the Jewish people, in a sense that God's relation to the Jewish people has never changed and remains in place, Christianity notwithstanding.
For a couple of thousand years, Jews were seen as the quintessential outsider in Western Christendom. Do you think we're moving into a situation now where perhaps Jews can, for the first time in 2,000 years, become insiders and see themselves as insiders, as very much part of Western civilization, even one of the foundation blocks of the West?
I think we're both insiders and outsiders in the sense that our separateness and our uniqueness are fundamental to the nature of the Jewish people. But in the other sense, we're the quintessential insiders because the Jewish idea, the idea that God has a special love for the poor and defenseless, which I consider to be the sine qua non of modern democracy, is so fundamentally a Jewish idea that Jews have a special and particularly valuable role to play in the West. And I very much hope Jews will remain deeply engaged in all the countries in which they reside, and help to make that idea palpable and real.
That was David Goldman, a.k.a. Spengler, whose columns in the Asia Times are available online, and you could do worse than to reread them. Now here's regular contributor Meryl Urish, who asks the question, how many czars does it take to screw in a light bulb?
This is Meryl Urish, and this is on Second Thought for Shire Network News. It seems the American president has hired a 9/11 truther to be his green job czar, which begs the question, what? You've heard by now that Van Jones is a far-left, radical, self-proclaimed communist who also happens to think that convicted Philadelphia cop killer Mumia Abu-Jamal is innocent. And this guy is in charge of a $30 billion department in the United States government. I don't know about you, but gee, I feel fine about that. So how many czars are there in Obama's cabinet anyway? And what do they do? Well, let's find out. There's an Afghanistan czar, an AIDS czar, an auto recovery czar, a border czar, a car czar, and a California water czar. There's a czar for climate, central region, what? Oh, the Middle East, the Gulf, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and South Asia. A domestic violence czar and a drug czar. We've got an economic czar, an energy and environment czar, a faith-based czar, a government performance czar, oh, that guy's going to have a lot to do, and a Great Lakes czar. Yes, really. There's our whack job green job czar, a Guantanamo czar, a health czar, an information czar, and no, I'm not nearly done yet. We have an intelligence czar, a Mideast peace czar, Mideast policy czar, a pay czar, that's executive pay, not concerned with us peons, a regulatory czar, stop laughing. I said stop laughing. A science czar and a stimulus accountability czar. You can laugh at that one. There's a Sudan czar, a TARP czar, a technology czar, a terrorism czar, an urban affairs czar, a weapons czar, and a WMD policy czar. Oh, and there's a healthcare disinformation czar, according to Glenn Reynolds. And there's also a cyberspace czar on the way, we're told. All of which leads me to say this. Hey there, you with the czars in your eyes. Actually, here's what I really think. Every single so-called czar is actually a government bureaucrat with the president's ear who did not have to be approved by Congress, which is why we have a nut job like Van Jones in charge of $30 billion of taxpayer money. And stop and think for a moment. What the heck is a green job? Seriously? Green jobs? Can you think of any possible career that would be totally eco-friendly? And I'm not going to count walking to work on your hippie commune to till the fields in the summertime. We have an environmental protection agency, yet the Great Lakes Czar is charged with advising the EPA about restoring the Great Lakes. Gee, that's not the least bit redundant or wasteful. In fact, just about every single czar Obama has appointed has duties that could be handled by existing government agencies. But then Obama couldn't be handing his friends all these high-paying jobs now, could he? Especially without congressional approval. This is all from the most transparent administration ever, bringing you the most accountable administration ever. Pay no attention to the 32 unvetted, unapproved czars behind the curtain. They're just Obama's panel of experts. Even the whack-job communist truthers.
And you can read more of Emeril's work at Eurish.com. The answer to the question, how many czars does it take to screw in a light bulb, is of course 4. One to monitor your home electricity usage to ensure you don't maximise your carbon footprint beyond new federally approved limits. One to approve your choice of eco-friendly mercury-based bulbs instead of those wasteful old-style bulbs. Remember kids, if your parents haven't made the right choice of light bulb, report them to a government official. One czar to monitor the safety regulations which come into force when you use a potentially deadly stepladder or chair. And one in charge of the actual screwing. President Obama wants everyone to be as screwed as possible. Well, that brings us to the end of this fortnight's edition of Shire Network News. I'm Tom Payne. Thanks for being with us. Doug Payton isn't with us this week as he's, quote, spending time with his family, unquote, on a camping expedition to a rural wilderness approximately 10 minutes from his house. You Americans going camping in the middle of a big city, I don't know. Still, your military kicks some serious ass. Hey, can we borrow it? You don't seem to be doing much with it these days. Okay, tell you what, just loan us the Pacific Fleet for the weekend. We'll have it back at Pearl Harbor by Monday morning. Honest, those scratches and scorch marks will buff right out. Most of them.